Okay, so let's do lecture 11 today. So far we have been talking about some hardware considerations. Okay, we talk about the threading hardware, we talk about the memory hardware, and we also talk about the control hardware, right? So at this time you have, you know, pretty good understanding of the overall structure, hardware structure that matters for performance. And before we actually go and start to apply all that knowledge to, I would call the application case studies, there's one more thing I wanted to talk about, which is floating point, okay? Floating point considerations. And you know what? If you think about it, one of the biggest values that the GPUs provide today is the massive floating point performance compared to all the previous hardware. In the past, we have had a lot of massive integer performance kind of hardware, which is DSP. Okay, so you know what, if you think about the sort of the additional step that these GPUs have, you know, the most important practical kind of visible contribution is this massive increase of floating point performance. However, many of you may not have a good understanding of what floating point really means. And in fact, when I was in grad school, I was a computer architecture grad student. And until I took a class from Belville Kahan, I never fully understood what floating point really means anyway. And you know, I took a couple lectures on the floating point and so on. And so, you know, finally, you know, Valvo was offering a course. So we ended up taking that course. And I walk in the classroom, there are only 7 people in that classroom. And so, you know, I was a little bit worried. You know, whenever you see a class of that size, you know, there's got to be something about it. So then someone was, you know, whispering, you know, here comes this guy who's not a numerical analysis student. And, you know, he probably doesn't understand what he's getting into, right? So, you know, so halfway through the lecture, I fell asleep. Okay, this is a real story. So halfway through that first lecture, I fell asleep. You know, I seldom fall asleep in these classes. And so, you know, I got my eyes got so heavy, and I fell asleep. And then when I woke up about 15 minutes later, I look around, everyone else was asleep as well. And so, you know what, ever since that time, you know what, I started to realize that floating point is one of those things that are, you know what, of a lot of practical value, but very few people really understand. So, you know what, it turned out that Valvo is truly brilliant in terms of the insight. So I managed to bring enough coffee to that class for the rest of the semester and stay awake enough that extracted some, you know what, I consider to be the most important part of these floating point, representations. And hopefully I will be able to teach you the kind of things that I found to be very useful over the years and still keep you awake, okay, through this lecture. So see how I do this time, okay? So let's first start. You know what, we'd like to help you to understand the fundamentals of floating point representation. In particular, you need to understand IEEE 754 floating point standard. And this is a standard that was truly attributed to Valvo Kahan. And this is the reason why he received the Turing Award, okay, a few years back. Because through his, you know, passion and through his evangelism, you know, he actually managed to convince all the computer manufacturers that it's not acceptable to have all these different, slightly different kinds of floating points, a representation, a slightly different semantics of floating point, that when you bring a program from one platform to another platform, you cannot expect to reproduce your numerical results. And he did so by actually going around, you know, I didn't see that, but legends are he was walking around with a trench coat, okay? And the trench coat will have 4 pockets. And each pocket will have one of those calculators. This, remember, this is in the late 70s and early 80s, right? So he will have these, you know, trench coat with all these, you know, calculators. And he will walk into a company and start to give these presentations about how terrible the floating point, you know, state of the art was. And then, you know, in the presentation, he will just flash his trench coat and say, pick any calculator, I'll show you, okay, any two calculators, and I'll show you the results will be different, right? So he really knew his stuff, and he tested all these calculators, and he was going around showing people why, you know, these things are not compatible. And he also showed people, you know, but more importantly, he also has a proposal that he has, right? And show the companies that, you know, if you do this, it would have been much better. So you cannot just criticize someone, right? You need to be prepared to propose something better, right? He did both, okay? And many, many years of this kind of effort, he finally got the companies to get together and drafted this standard, okay? And, you know, the world is different ever since, okay? So now all of you are taking for granted that all these computer chips IEEE floating point standard implementation. Okay, it's almost inconceivable to buy a, you know, that you can buy a computer without a IEEE floating point standard on it. Okay, so GeForce 8800 CUDA floating point, you know, there are some speed, accuracy, and precision considerations you need to understand. Okay, when you program this chip or any chip, you need to actually have some pretty good understanding of the trade-offs between speed, accuracy, and precision. And I'm going to talk about all, you know, what is accuracy or what is precision in this whole business. In particular, you should also understand what are the deviations from IEEE 754. Just like any standard, people would implement the standard as much as possible. But sometimes these standards are one size for all, okay? And there may be certain situations where the standard would have been too costly to implement, and a lot of these manufacturers actually cut corners in the places where they consider to be not critical for their customers, and we're going to see some of that. Accuracy of device runtime functions. When you call these functions, okay, you need to understand what kind of accuracy these functions give you. And you know what, in a lot of situations when people don't understand these things, they will call the functions and they'll say, oh, this, you know, this thing is wrong and so on. But it turned out that, you know, there's some accuracy, you know what, that, you know what, considerations that these people just don't understand. When you have fast math compiler option, that means some of these floating point functions are going to be executed by hardware, by that super function unit. And the accuracy of that computation is also a little bit different, okay? So you would need to be prepared to sacrifice a little bit of accuracy, and I will tell you how much. And the future performance, you know, considerations. When you go from one SDK to another SDK, unless you do certain things, your program performance could vary by going from one generation to another next generation. In fact, from G80 to G280, some of these things already happened. Okay, so we need to, you know, take you through some of these cases and so that you understand, you know, what are the pitfalls. And we're not gonna talk about CUDA or multi-core today, and it will be, you know, actually a topic that we're gonna cover later on. So before I talk about this, you know, I'm going to play one of the tricks that I really disliked from some of my previous teachers. Okay, some of my previous teachers tried to get our attention by showing us a slide that, you know, essentially we look at the slide and we get intimidated, right? And then they say, okay, if you listen to me, you will not be intimidating, you know, after the lecture, right? So this is kind of one of those tricks, right? You show someone that you don't understand some things, and then, you know, someone, oh, okay, I don't understand it. And then you take them through the stuff so that they're motivated to listen. So this is one of those slides that is, you know, a little bit intimidating unless you really understand floating point. And my mission today is to make sure that at the end of the lecture, you look at the slide, you'll say, no, this is not intimidating at all, right? So you look at, if you look at the columns of this graph, you will see G80, SSE, meaning it's the Intel multimedia extension, the streaming extension, and IBM Altivec extension, and Cell, IBM Cell SPE, floating point, okay? So it summarizes the floating point characteristics of all these hardware in what, as they implement the IEEE standard. And then there are multiple ways that you can look at a standard. You know, if you need to give a grading sheet about how good the implementations are, there are actually quite a few areas that you can give a grade and say, oh, this is compliant. Or you can say, oops, you know, this is the part that they really cut corners, okay? So the first one is rounding mode for floating point add and floating point multiply, okay? And it turned out that IEEE standard specifies 5 different rounding modes. I don't know if when you write a program, if you ever, you know, select a particular rounding mode the system is going to use. But you actually, if you look into the compiler options, you will see that there are certain ways that you can set the rounding mode for your floating point add and multiply. Very few people actually use it, okay? And most people use round to the nearest with, you know what, because, you know what, that's statistically the best mechanism. On the other hand, you can also choose to always round to the positive infinity, negative infinity, towards zero, you know, so you have all these different rounding modes that you can choose. So because most people, you know what, don't really choose the rounding mode, a lot of these manufacturers only support a subset of the rounding modes, okay? And, you know, for example, G80 supports, you know, round to the nearest and also round to the towards zero, okay? So those are the two rounding modes that this particular hardware supports. And the SSE hardware from Intel supports all the 4 IEEE, rounding modes, in fact, that's right, nearest, zero, infinity, negative infinity. So this is probably the most comprehensive implementation of IEEE, and given Intel's history, this is not surprising, because Intel 8087 was the first full-blown commercial implementation of IEEE standard. This company has a long history of implementing IEEE standard floating point in their hardware. And if you have used the IEEE, the first 8087, you will probably remember each floating point operation takes hundreds of clock cycles. And it runs at something like 1 megahertz, okay? So these things can, you know, was really, really slow, but they actually took the pain to implement, you know, all these things, you know, quite accurately. So if you look at IBM Altivec, you know what, it only supports round to the nearest, and then IBM Cell report only supports round to zero and truncate. Round to zero and truncate are not necessarily going to be the same thing, okay? So it's left for your exercise, okay? And actually, no, round to zero is truncate. So, you know, I'll leave it as an exercise for you to figure out. So essentially, when you round, you just take whatever number of digits that you cannot afford to represent in your format, throw them away, okay? And it's not round to the nearest, because round to the nearest sometimes require you to add a little bit to the digit in front of you, right? So you know, to start to think about these things. And I'm going to actually show you some examples to, you know, that some of these things will become concrete. And there is the second one that people often care about is the normal handling, okay? And at this point, it may not make a whole lot of sense to some of you. How many of you have heard of the normal numbers? How many of you? Yeah. So you know what? Not surprising. On the other hand, the handling of the denormalized numbers is one of the most contentious areas in numerical analysis. Oftentimes, a lot of the numerical analysis algorithms require accurate handling of denormalized numbers, Okay, and especially in like time domain, finite difference kind of methods. Oftentimes, you need to have very accurately normalized number handle in order to converge on the electrical charge and so on. Okay, so that's why, you know, it could be very important. GAD just flushed to zero. That is, it doesn't even produce denormalized numbers. Yes?
So what is denormalized?
Ah, I'm going to introduce you. See, I'm intimidating you at this point. This is the reason why I said up front, okay, I'm using a technique that I often dislike. But for floating point, because people fall asleep so easily, you know, I resorted to that particular technique to keep you awake. Okay, so you know what? Bear with me in a few slides, it will become very clear. SSE supports denormalized numbers. However, if you ever get into a situation where you need to generate a denormalized number, okay, or you need to use a denormalized number with a non-denormalized number, it can take thousands of clock cycles for the hardware to actually do the right things, okay, to line up all the numbers so that they can do the proper operation. And it will be clear to you in a few slides. Not a number. You know what? You may run into a situation where the computation doesn't make sense. If you have a divide by zero, okay, or you know what, some of these things that just don't make sense, you should generate not a number rather than a arbitrary number. So the first three hardware, you know what, support not a number, but the cell processor does not. Why? Because in cell design, I don't know if you have, you know, read some of the articles back in the early 2000. When IBM designed the first cell, it was actually meant to be one of the highest frequency chips that are available around. In fact, IBM was one of the first companies that break the 1 gigahertz clock cycle, you know, with the IBM cell design. So, you know, a lot of this hardware that would have required longer signal path got dropped, okay? And so they essentially designed this piece of hardware to be extremely fast, okay? But not necessarily very accurate, okay? And you know what, if you look at the cell applications, a lot of the, you know, the most important application for cell today is actually PS3, right? You know, PS3, exactly, not PS4. We're not at PS4 yet. So PS3 is a game console. There are lots and lots of floating point calculation, but the accuracy of the floating point is not critical. As long as it looks good, it doesn't matter. Okay, so that's why, you know, they can get away with it. And not a number support, so overflow and infinity support, flags, square root, division, reciprocal estimate, reciprocal square root, power of 2, and you know, it will show you the number of bits, okay, that are accurate in these, you know, calculations. And you will see some interesting trade-offs. Like in G80, for reciprocal square root, it will give you 23 bits of accuracy. Okay. However, in the SSE hardware, in these other hardware, they only give you 12 bits of accuracy. That also has to do with one thing. G80 implements the parallelism by having a lot of these SPs. Remember those streaming processors? However, in SSE, when they implement the hardware, they actually, you know, essentially take the ALU of the CPU and then chop it into pieces, and then use the pieces of the ALU to do the calculations. That's how they could get a lot of calculations done. But in that process, they reduce the number of bits that they could dedicate to each operation because they're using only a part of the ALU. Whereas in G80, they actually dedicate entire ALUs to every floating point operation. So I'm talking to you about some of the hardware design trade-offs. That's not the main topic. But for some of you who care about this and eventually want to know more about these things, you know, hopefully this is going to give you a little bit of a foundation. Now, let's get into, you know, the kind of the sleepy part. So what is IEEE floating point format? You ask what is denormalized number, you know, but we really should ask the question, you know, what is IEEE floating point anyway? So it's a floating point binary number, okay, representation that consists of three parts, okay? So the first part is a sign bit. It's one bit, okay? You have to have that sign bit so that you can represent both the positive number and negative numbers. The second one is exponent, okay? That exponent allows you to represent the 2 to the power part of the floating point number or your scientific notation, right? Now, it's not a base of 10, it's a base of 2. And the third one is mantissa. That's where all the precision comes from. That's the part that you use to represent all the significant digits of the floating point number. The trade-off is always given a particular number, okay? Representation, let's say 32 bits or 64 bits. The trade-off is always how do we allocate bits to the exponents versus the mantissa. If you allocate more bits to the mantissa, you could represent numbers more accurately or more precisely. Okay, you can have more and more significant digits. But if you allocate more bits to the exponent, you can represent numbers in bigger and smaller ranges. Okay, you can represent very big numbers and very small numbers if you allocate more bits to the exponent. So it's always a kind of an intrinsic trade-off. For single precision, most people settle to have about 7 bits of exponent, about 24 bits of mantissa, okay? And there are some minor variations, but just from numerical analysis point of view, most people seem to agree that that's the right balance, okay, between the two. So for each bit pattern, there is a way of interpreting those bits, okay? That's where the foundation of the standard comes in. If you see a 32-bit pattern, and if I ask you what that number is in a computer architecture course, the right answer in the final exam is I don't know, okay? Because the 32 bits could be of integer format, right? Could be of signed integer format or unsigned integer format, could be of floating point format. Depending on which format you're talking about, those bits mean different things. So the floating point format, according to IEEE, you will take sign to interpret as either positive or negative. And the way to represent it mathematically is by having negative 1 raised to the power of s. And note, and remember, s can only be 0 or 1 because there's only one bit. Any number raised to the power of 0 is always 1. So that's why it becomes a positive number. Any number raised to the power of 1, wait, let me repeat. Any number raised to the power of 0 is always 1. So that's how you get a positive number. Any number raised to the power of 1 is itself. That's why it's negative. Okay. So that gives you either a negative or positive 1, multiplied by the rest. The rest is interpreted as mantissa, so you will multiply that positive 1 or negative 1 by the mantissa, which is a fraction. Okay, and it's not exactly a fraction, it's actually a fraction between 1 and 2. Okay, it's very specific. That fraction can only be in between 1 and 2, nothing, nowhere else. The reason is floating point numbers can be very shifty. Unless you narrow down exactly the range that the mantissa can take, you can always take 1 out of your power, okay, and then shift your mantissa to the right or to the left and have the same value. So in order to get a unique representation, you have to nail it down. You have to say, I only accept mantissas within a certain range. It cannot be bigger than this. It cannot be smaller than this. So every time you generate a floating number the first thing you do is you shift the mantissa into the acceptable range, and whatever is left in the power gives you the exponent. Okay, so that's why the interpretation, you know what, is fairly simple once you understand what it is. And 1.0 is a binary is 2, 1, and then 10.0 binary is actually 2, right? So, you know, that's just all digital representation notation. Okay, so far so good. So we have this thing called normalize. We're two slides into answering your question. So of the normalized representation is based on the following concept. You say, hey, my mantissa is always going to be between 1.0 and 1.0 binary, okay? So that means all the numbers that I'm going to accept, all the numbers I'm going to accept will start with a 1 point, okay? They all be of the form 1 point. So what's the point? If you have 1 point, what's the point of representing the 1 point, right? So you eliminate that 1 point. So if you have, let's say, you know what, 0.5 decimal, if you convert it to a floating point format, will become 1.0 binary times 2 to the negative 1. 2 to the negative 1 is half, right? So that's 0.5. So you will never have 0.0 times 2 to the negative 2 or 0.1 times 2 to the 0 for that representation. You will only accept 1.0 here. So if you only accept that, then that 1.0 really doesn't have to be represented. So the mantissa representation for that 0.5 is actually all zeros. You take that leading 1.0, throw it away, and only represent all zero for the 0.5. So unless you really understand this, looking at the number format will not help you, right? So the mantissa value of 0.5 in a hypothetical 2-point mantissa is actually just 0, 0. If I allocated 2 bits in the floating point format for mantissa, those 2 bits will be 0, 0, because the 1 point in front of it is implicit, okay? It's not represented. This saves some bit patterns and allow you to represent more numbers and stretch out more precision, right, for a given number of bits. Because now you can represent more towards the back. You can, you know, represent more of those digits. One more of those digits, okay? So that's normalized representation. Now, here's an exponent representation. The most straightforward representation for the exponent would have been a signed integer representation. And you know, it would have been something like, for those of you who have learned digital logic, you could have the actual numbers that you're trying to represent. So, you know, let's say if I have a 3-bit number, okay, then I can represent 8-bit patterns. So I can represent 8 values, right? So I need to represent positive exponents and negative exponents. So a very natural, intuitive way of representing the positive and negative exponents is what we call the 2's complement numbers. And the mapping is actually very easy. The 0 is 0, 0, 0, 1 is 1, 0, 1, 0 is 2, 0, 1, 1 is 3. So you increase from 0, you get all the positive numbers. And then once you have a 1 in the front, you use that as essentially a sign. So all the numbers with the 1 leading 1 becomes negative. And then you can actually increase, increment from, from 1, 0, 0, which is the most negative. And then you have negative 3, negative 2, negative 1. So this gives you the full range of truth complement representation. It turns out that if you look at the IEEE floating point numbers, that's not how it works. They actually use what we call the excess representation. The excess representation takes whatever you will use in the truth complement and add an offset to it. So you will actually, in a 3-bit situation, you will actually add a 3. It's essentially 2 to the n minus 1. So in a 4-bit representation, you will add a 7, which is 3 1-bits in the end. If you have a 5-bit representation, you will add 15, which is 4 runs. So it's always 2 to the n minus 1. Okay? And why is that? Because after you added this to the offset, and you start to realize that the smallest number, which is negative 3, now becomes 0. So you can use an unsigned integer comparison to compare two numbers. You don't need to know that it's a signed number, and you don't need to do do some kind of subtraction in order to figure out which one's bigger, which one's smaller. You can just use an unsigned integer representation, comparison to figure out which number is bigger. And in the early days, when the hardware is very expensive, this saves a lot of hardware in the floating point ALU. And that's why it is what it is. Today, if you ask me, it may not be that important anymore. This also gives you a kind of an interesting opportunity. If you look at the numbers that you can represent, you have 0, you have 3 positive numbers, and you have 3 negative numbers. That's 7 of them. But in a truth complement number, you would have 4 negative numbers. So you have one more negative number than positive numbers that you can represent in any of these number formats. And you know what? You see what I'm saying? This would have been negative 4, okay, in the truth complement. So you will have 4 negative numbers, only 3 positive numbers. Most mathematicians don't like this kind of asymmetry. Okay, most mathematicians would like to have the same positive numbers as the same negative numbers you can represent. So what they did was they took away the most negative number. Okay, take away the most negative number, which in the excess pattern is 111. Okay, that's the most negative number. And make that number into not a number. It's a special bit pattern that is reserved to represent not a number or infinity. Okay. So this representation gives you a very convenient way of identifying a number that is not a number. Okay. So you can use that as a trap, for example, where you can initialize your data structure with all not a number, floating point, values, just all not a number. And unless you initialize that data structure with a valid value, if you accidentally use that value, it will trap you. It will say, oh, you're trying to add another number to another number, and it will actually cause some problems that you can detect the fact that you didn't initialize data structure. Okay, so that's one very typical use of these representations. Now, so let's say if I have a simple hypothetical 5-bit floating point format, according to IEEE, then the 5-bit format would probably look at something like this. You always have 1 bit of sign. You probably would dedicate at least 2 bits to exponents so you have a reasonable range. And you have 2 bits of mantissa to have some reasonable accuracy, precision. So for a 0.5 decimal value, it's really 1.00 times 2 to the negative 1. And as I told you, with the mantissa representation, that 1-0 is lost in the representation. It's omitted. So you will have 0 for the sign, 0-0 for the mantissa, and then eventually 0, and also 0-0 in the exponent, because negative 1 in a 2-bit excess representation is actually 0. Okay? And the exponent will come before the mantissa. okay? Because exponents are much more important in terms of number size comparisons. If a number has a bigger exponent, it doesn't matter what the mantissa is, if the number is bigger. So if you lined up the sign, the mantissa, the exponent and mantissa in that order, you can compare a floating point number just as if it is a signed integer number. Okay, it works. So that's also another reason why, you know what, in the early days when people built these floating point units, they will do comparators as integer comparators. Okay. So, you know, for those of you who write programs, you know what, this is kind of a nice trivia to know, but I'm not going to test you in the you know what, necessary test you in some of these details in the final exam, especially the hardware considerations. But it's important for you to be able to recognize how to interpret the values given a bit pattern, or at least be able to synthesize the bit patterns according to the value you're trying to represent, because that capability gives you some good intuition about the numbers that you're dealing with. So let's talk about an interesting problem. The interesting problem is representable numbers. Okay. For any kind of number system, given limited number of bits, there's always a limitation of how many numbers you can represent. If you have a 32-bit format, you only have up to 4 billion gigas, it's billion giga, yeah, 4 gig number of patterns in that in that representation. So you can only have 4 gig numbers that you can represent. Okay, if you extend your format to 64 bits, then you have a lot more, right? So in every format, given any number of bits, you have a limited number of bit patterns that you can represent. So let's say if I take a 3-bit, you know, format, okay, if I give you 3 bits and say represent numbers with those 3 bits, you're gonna have to make some hard choices about what are the numbers you can represent with those 3 bits. You only have 8 patterns to work with. So the representable numbers, in this case, if you don't care about negative numbers, then you will just put all your bit patterns into the positive range. Then you can represent from 0 to 7, okay? And that gives you the most positive numbers that you can represent, right? And if you care about negative numbers, then you will have to dedicate some of the bit patterns to negative numbers. Then you will have some positive numbers that you will not be able to represent. So that's how you make these trade-offs. So if I draw a number line, okay, and then say, given the 3-bit number, 3 bits, if I only want to represent 0 and positive numbers, what are the numbers I can represent? You will have those 8 numbers marked on the number line, and these are the representable numbers, right, for the system that you're building, okay? So that's fairly straightforward. So let's get some numbers here. This is where I started to fall asleep, by the way, just for your information, okay? Halfway through the table, I was gone.
Right.
So, you know what, the representable numbers of a 5-bit, of that 5-bit hypothetical format that I just talked about, one sign, two exponent, and two mantissa, you can actually do an exercise by listing for all the bit patterns you can have, right? All the 32-bit patterns you can have, then you can, according to IEEE standard, you can write down the interpretation of those values. Let me take the first one. If you have, you know what, exponent 0, mantissa 0, then you can have either sign 0 or 1. So the first, you know, the first exponent 0, 0, you can have up to 4 different mantissa patterns, right? So this is just a combinatorial listing of all the bit patterns of how you can interpret those numbers. Take the first one. If all bits are 0, I already show you how to do that for, you know, for the IEEE, right? So it's really 1.0, 0.00, right, times 2 to the negative 1, because that 0, 0 is an excess representation. It has already been added 1, okay, to it. So a 0 really means negative 1. A 1 really means 0, right? So this gives you 1.00 times 2 to the negative 1, and that's a half, right? So that's the value you have. And the second value is 1.01, which means it's 2 to the 0 plus 2 to the negative 2 times negative 1. So that's how you get 2 to the negative 1 plus 2 to the negative 3. And that gives you another value, right? So if you listed all these values, okay, and in the final exam, I fully expect you to be able to go back and forth freely, right? And then you have, you know what, all the 32 possible values in your system. But the first, remember that 1, 1 exponent value is taken away, so you don't have numerical value for that, right? So that's not a number representation. So that's why I don't have the numerical value for that, right? So this is the IEEE floating point representable numbers of a 5-bit format, okay? A 5-bit representation according to what we have had so far, okay? What we have talked about so far. And you look at this, okay? You look at this. Say, okay, here are the, in reality, you know, all the numbers that I can represent, 4, 4, 4, 12, 4, 4, 4, 12, 24 numbers, you know, I can represent. What's wrong with this system? Can someone tell me what is wrong with the system that we have discussed so far? Is there some kind of very important thing that is missing from the system? Yes.
Is there no zero?
There's no zero. That's right. There's no zero. And why does it matter? You know, why does zero even matter in our world? The reason is zero is very important because the world is, you know, if you look at the universe, the vacuum, okay, is the vast majority of the space, and that's zero, okay? So that's why if you have a floating point number that you cannot represent zero, you're in serious, serious trouble. You can never design a TV without noise, okay? Zero, you know, zero gives you that flat screen, okay, the black screen. If you don't have a zero, you always have noise on the screen, and it will drive you crazy. So what people did with this kind of representation is actually to, you know, Digital Equipment Corporation, for example, in the early days, used a representation that is very similar to this, okay? So, you know, they didn't invent IEEE standard out of vacuum, okay? It's all these things are evolution. So what happened in the digital format is that they just took the values with exponent zero, okay? All those values, whenever the exponent is zero, it's interpreted as zero, okay? So it's an easy detection, okay? Every time the exponent all fall into zero, bam, it becomes, you know what, it becomes zero value. And if you think about it, remember this is an excess representation, right? Remember the exponent is excess representation. So you're taking the most negative exponent that you can get and make it into zero, which is logical. Because when you have the most negative exponents, that means that these are very small values, okay? Very small values close to zero. These are 1 over some big exponents, okay? When you have a negative exponent, it's really 1 over a big exponent, a number with big exponents. So it's 1 over a big number. And that means that you are really close to zero. So you're taking away some values that are very close to zero and make them into zero. Isn't that a very logical decision, right? I mean, you know, when it's sufficiently close to zero, it's like a black hole. You just suck all the values into zero, okay? That's not bad. Except when someone writes a program, then they will start to get some surprises. Okay. Here are the surprises that they have.
you have the represent, once you plot out the representable numbers, you will see a very desirable pattern of precision, okay? You will see that for large numbers, okay, for the large numbers, the distance between representable numbers are bigger, okay? For smaller numbers, the distance between representable numbers are smaller. And this is very, very logical. If you have a lot of money, okay, then you know what, losing a couple thousand dollars may not matter. If you are a professor, losing a couple dollars may matter. So if, you know, when Bill Gates look at his assets, he's probably looking for, you know, units of tens of billions. He probably doesn't care about anything other than that. But if he accidentally drop one of his 1 billion into my account, I will feel it. He may not feel it, right? So that's why when you have a small number that you need to play with, you need to represent that small number accurately. When you have a very big number to play with, sometimes you don't need to worry about as much accuracy as you're playing with smaller numbers. So that's exactly the reason why people use floating point representation. It's not because it necessarily gives you more accuracy or precision. It's not always the case. Sometimes integer representation give you even more precision in certain ranges, okay? It's because the precision that you have is actually proportional to the magnitude of the numbers, okay? So that you can have more and more precision as the number gets smaller, and less precision as the number gets bigger, so that you can cover a wide range of numbers and still get some reasonable numerical property. Yes, Maddie? I use those terms interchangeably so far, but we should begin to separate. Precision means it's the number of bits that you can have available to represent the number. The more bits you have for the mantissa, the more precision you have. Accuracy usually has to do with operations. When you implement an algorithm such as a division algorithm, such as a sine algorithm, such as cosine algorithm, oftentimes we will use approximation algorithms. Oftentimes we'll use a Taylor series expansion and then take the first few terms. When you use those kind of approximation in your hardware design, you may not be able to generate the accuracy, the number of significant digits that your number representation can take, because the hardware was limited in the number of bits that it can generate. So that's called accuracy. You may have an accuracy that is smaller than the number precision you have. Okay, and we're going to see that several more times. Now, let's focus on precision for now. If you look at this and say, okay, I have very big numbers, they're far apart, and then I go into these, you know, modest numbers, and they're modest apart, and I have these small numbers, they're small apart, and then I go into these very small numbers, and they're far apart, because you lost several numbers. And this is an exaggerated figure in the sense that there are only four numbers in that range, eight numbers in that range that was, you know, taken away, or four numbers, I don't remember exactly what. So when you take away those numbers, you actually have a bad situation where if a number falls into a very, very small range, you are actually forced to choose either zero or one in this case, and they are very far away. So you run into a situation where you have the smallest numbers in your range that actually lose a lot more than the larger numbers. And this becomes a problem when you have a situation where some of these algorithms may be generating some very small numbers, okay? In the process, they may be generating smaller and smaller numbers. And then eventually you'll divide another number by that small number and generate a bigger number. So whenever you fall into this very small range, you're forced to introduce some, you know, big error into that. And then when you divide that another number by that number, you magnify the error, okay? And suddenly you start to have numerical instability in your algorithms. And that's exactly what a lot of people discover in the early VAX hardware, when they use the early VAX hardware to execute some of these numerical algorithms. People started to discover some problems with antenna design and so on that they couldn't, you know what, converge on their hardware design, okay? And so that problem with, you know, flush to zero. So what people, what IEEE floating point did is to say, well, I'm going to, you know what, I'm in the situation where, you know, I need the most accuracy. So whenever the number falls into that smallest range, remember that 5-bit representation, whenever the exponents become zero, instead of calling all these numbers zero, I'm only going to make one of them zero, okay? But I'm going to change the interpretation so that the one point no longer applies. Okay, I no longer use the one point in my interpretation. But rather, I'm gonna just use 0 point, okay, for those numbers. Okay, I'm gonna change the interpretation. And then I'm also going to change the way I interpret the exponent. So the exponent interpretation is changed. And I would be a very bad teacher if I require you to remember that formula. Okay, even though I was asked to remember that formula when I took the course. So, but what I want you to remember is that this formula is actually designed to make sure that those remaining numbers, once you take away the zero, the remaining numbers are spread evenly across the final range. Okay, so in the 5-bit example, the numbers that, you know what, the numbers in that range are now being spread with equal distance in that final range so that the accuracy of the final range is actually going to be the same as the previous section, okay? So ideally, you want that to be even smaller, right? But you couldn't do that. You would have lost zero. So you added a zero, and then you spread out the rest of the numbers, so that at least you get even equal kind of precision as what you had before that range, the second smallest section. So this is how the denormalized numbers actually work, okay? So every time you generate a zero exponent value, the hardware actually changes the interpretation of those numbers and generate a denormalized representation for you, okay? And that denormalized representation actually requires the hardware to do something different. And also, when you have a denormalized number, before you can use that number to add or subtract or multiply with another number, you need to actually convert it into a compatible format with the other numbers so that you can do the, you know, the addition and multiplication correctly. So this is where the overhead starts. Whenever you have such a situation, you know, the hardware essentially say, ooh, this is a number that I, you know, I cannot just do the addition or subtraction without special attention. So oftentimes in the SSE implementation, what that means is the hardware is going to vomit, okay? It's going to say, I can't take this. And then it will cause a trap, and then the trap will bring in the operating system. The operating system will bring in a library. The library will do the stuff, and then, you know what, do the stuff. And then eventually it will happen, right? And eventually, some of the implementations, I believe the more recent implementations use microcode. So at least they don't use the operating system. But still, the microcode will take a large number of clock cycles to actually line things up properly and so on, when you have denormalized numbers. So the net benefit is that you now have a much more uniform precision in the smallest range. There's no abrasion. rot, drop of precision when you go into these small number ranges.
Yes.
I didn't understand one thing, which is actually crucial, is, but why do I have less numbers to represent the space between the bigger numbers? I mean, if I have a larger exponent,
yeah.
I don't have more digits for the Mantissa.
Ah, okay. So the question is, if you have, you know, a number with large number of large exponent, why do you have fewer numbers that you can represent, right? So it's not that you have fewer numbers to represent. It's more like, you know what, for every exponent value, right, you have the same number of Mantissa bits. So, but there's, because the exponent is bigger, you spread them out.
Yeah.
Okay. Exactly the same number of bits. Good question. Okay. Trust me, when you go home, when you think about these things, you will have several times of, you know, think questions like this. But those are great questions. Once you work through those questions, you actually really know floating point. And why does it matter? Because floating point is a very imprecise representation, if you think about it, of all these numbers. So until you get a really good feeling about, you know, where the impreciseness going happen, you may not be able to master the use of floating point. And oftentimes, for those of you who, you know, have the, you're lucky enough to work on physics and, you know, work on some of these engineering applications, your convergence is all about, you know, how you work with these precisions and so on, okay? And, you know, you can run into all kinds of trouble unless you have some good intuition about how, you know, these things work. So once you have denormalization, what happens is, remember those four numbers, right, that all got swapped to zero? Now you take those four numbers, make one of them zero, okay, and then spread out the rest to cover that last range. And the distance between these numbers will be exactly the same as these numbers. And that property holds when you have much bigger representations. So if you have a single precision, double precision, it's always going to be the same. That very last segment of all zero exponent value, but now you have a whole lot more Mantissa, right? There's, you know, they're going to be just spread out to the same distance with each other as the previous, you know, exponent value. Okay, so that property holds for all the representations. Now, so that's what denormalization means. And denormalization comes with a cost. The cost is you either have a lot more hardware to handle these cases and line them up right on the spot, or you can call the microcode. And, you know, in Intel's case, microcode is part of their life. But in GPU designs, you know, it's not clear if they want to do all that microcode work. So that's why in G80, when they first came up with the design, they only supported normalized numbers, and then they just flushed to zero, okay? And that's essentially Digital Equipment Corporation design style. And then after they used this in the field for a while, sure enough, a lot of the numerical people started to tell them that this is not acceptable. So in G280, now they actually start to support the normalized numbers. Okay. So you know what? These things are all of growing, you know, these are all kind of evolving products. Okay. Nothing is sacred, nothing is, you know what, unchangeable. If enough of the customers tell them that they need to have certain, you know, improvements, if enough of the customers say so, it will eventually happen. Okay. So you know what? Now let's take a look at, you know what, some other aspects of the floating point. So one of the important considerations is the throughput of the arithmetic instructions, okay? So let's say integer instructions and floating point, you know, add, subtract, shift, min, max, you know, multiply and add. All these instructions have four clock cycles per instruction throughput. That is, every time a warp is ready to execute a floating point hack, let's say. Remember that zero overhead schedule, right? So the instruction goes into the hardware. It will occupy the hardware for four clock cycles before another instruction could go into that piece of hardware, okay? So you have four clock cycles of occupancy, okay? And then another instruction will come in for four clock cycles. And we talk about this. The reason is you have only eight of those units, right? And each warp has 32 threads. So you need to have four clock cycles just to be able to run eight each time through the pipeline. And the real latency is actually a little longer because the floating point units are pipeline. But from the, you know, but you have so many threads, so what really happens is how quickly the instructions can actually be shoved down the pipeline. And the fact that for each thread, it may take a little longer or something, it doesn't matter. So that's why the throughput matters here. And then you know what, you have all these four cycle latencies. And I believe that integer arithmetic, okay, actually has improved, meaning that in the early days, the 24-bit integers are as fast floating point. If you use 32-bit integers, it may actually take more than four clocks per warp instruction. And the reason is, think about it, GPUs are actually built as floating point engines. So the addition and subtraction and all these things are built around the floating point needs. And then they happen to execute integer operations. Whereas the CPUs are built the other way around. The CPUs are primarily built for integer operations. And then they add the floating point units on the side to execute floating point units. So in the first few generations of the GPU, what happens is they only need to have 24 bits in the ALU to add up the floating point mantissa. So if you happen to use a 32-bit integer, it will be executed as two packs. You know, you will do 24 bits at a time, and then you finish up the 8 bits. So you actually take the floating point units more time, more runs to process the integer, 32-bit integer, than floating point. So that's why a lot of people feel that this is ridiculous. Why do you have slower integer performance than floating point? From CPU, if you come from the CPU perspective, it's just ridiculous to have integers slower than floating point. It's really 32-bit integers were slower than the 24-bit integers. Okay, and the 24-bit integers are running as fast as the floating point calculations, okay? However, because people are using the GPUs for more and more computing, now most of these SPALUs are now 32 bits, okay? So the speed penalty for using integers is disappearing. Again, you know, none of these things is sacred. You know, these things all evolve according to the actual usage of the chip in the real world, okay? So integer divide and modulo are very expensive, okay? So if you have a piece of C code where you did a percentage sign, where you did a divide sign between integers, those things are very expensive. Those things are more expensive than, you know, the floating point computation. So the compiler will convert the literal power of two divides to ships. So if you have something like an integer value divided by two, the compiler will generate the integer value right shift by one bit, okay? And they will do this as much as possible because there's huge incentive to avoid integer divide and modulo operations. So by if you want to make sure that the conversion happens. That is, if you're going to divide the number, okay, by divide the number by a, let's say, a variable, but you know for sure that the variable is going to be a power of 2, then you need to force the compiler to do this kind of transformation. Okay? And so the useful trick is that you can do, you know what, if it's, you know what, a remainder of a power of 2, then you can just minus subtract 1, that gives you all 1s in lower digits, and then you do an AND. So you avoided a remainder operation by just doing an AND, AND mask operation. So these are the little tricks that some of the programmers do to avoid very expensive integer division and modulo operations. Reciprocal square root, sine, cosine, log, exponent. If you use underscore in front of the function call, they will use the hardware. Okay? They will use the hardware implementation, the super function unit hardware. However, the throughput is you will take 16 cycles per warp. Okay, rather than the 4 cycles per warp. The logic is actually very simple. The reason is very simple. If you look at the picture that we showed, you know, earlier, there are 8 of those, streaming processors, but there are only 2 super function units in each SM. So every four of those SPs need to share 1 super function unit. That's why the throughput is 1/4 of the floating point multiply and add, because now the 32 threads need to go through super function units by having essentially 2 threads each time in the SN, okay, 2 threads a time. And if you divide 32 by 2, that means that you have to have 16 cycles just to be able to, you know, to get all the operations into that pipeline. And that's why it's 16 cycles per warp. And there are other functions that you can do as a combination. So for example, if you want to divide y by x as a floating point operation, what you will do is you will actually do a reciprocal of x, and then you multiply that reciprocal by y. Multiply and the reciprocal is much faster than the division, because the division is not fully pipelined, whereas in this machine, the reciprocal is fully pipelined in the super function unit, and multiply is fully pipelined. So if you use the combination of the two, you get much, much faster and higher throughput, okay, through your hardware compared to, you know, implementation. So full division. So if you do a reciprocal kind of multiply, it's 20 cycles per warp, because it's 16 cycles for the reciprocal in that super function unit, and then 4 cycles for the multiply. Okay, and that gives you about 20 cycles. The square root is reciprocal plus, you know, followed by a reciprocal square root. So it turned out that the reciprocal square root is easier to implement than the square root itself. So if you need to do a square root, the best way to do this on this machine is by doing a reciprocal square root and then do a reciprocal, right? And each one requires a super function unit pass. So that's why 16 plus 16, it gives you 32. Yes?
Are these exchanges handled in the assembler compiler thing, or do we have to do these manually?
No. Remember, you know what, when you write the source code, you will do the __. And if you have a square root that you really want to call, you need to do manual conversion into this. Because it turns out that the division and reciprocal will give you a little bit different accuracy. So that's why the compiler or assembler cannot do it automatically for you. You need to volunteer, okay? Now, so there is a runtime math library, okay? And so there are really 2 types of runtime library. The __ functions are directly mapped to the hardware, and sine, cosine, exponent, they all have these, you know, hardware versions. And then you have, you know, if you don't use __, they actually go into the multiple instruction, software implementation. It's slower,
but it's higher accuracy. Because in the software implementation, you can afford to iterate more times. Okay, it's not limited by the clock frequency and so on. And that, so if you go into software, you can afford to do more iterations and then crank out more terms of your Taylor series and so on, that you can afford to produce more accurate results. So, you know what, these implementations will have 5 ULP, and this is a very frequently used term in the floating point accuracy world. ULP stands for units in the least place, okay? What does this mean? If you are given a number of pieces of bits, you take the last bit and ask, what is the weight or the place value of this bit? That's called the value of the least place, okay? If you have 2 bits in your Mantissa, the last bit is in 1/4, right? The value is 1/4. If you have 5 bits, the last bit is 1/32. So the value of that place value of that last bit in your Mantissa gives you the units in the least place. So what this means is that 5 ULP means that the error that you're going to have after the division is done, after this computation is done, is never more than 5 times of that place value. Okay, so you will never have more than 5 times the weight or the place value of your last digit. That's called 5 ULP accuracy, okay? In some of the hardware implementations, you may end up with only, let's say for 3-bit Mantissa or 24-bit Mantissa, you may only end up with somewhere around 17 or, you know what, 15 or 12 bit of accuracy, but you need to look at the manual, you know, to see for that particular chip what kind of accuracy that you're getting out of that chip. My impression is if you compare 280 with G80, I actually haven't done that, but most people tell me that the 280 implementation is now giving you more accuracy in the superfunction unit than the G80 implementation, okay, in quite a few of those functions. So you can probably expect that as hardware, you know, you get into future generations of hardware, the gap between the accuracy of the software implementation and the hardware implementation will continue to narrow. And they will squeeze in more and more hardware to be able to generate more and more accurate results out of these hardware function units. If you really want to make sure that your floating point performance stays the same and accuracy stays the same from generation to generation, then you need to make your program what we call the float safe. That means it has to do with the presence of double precision in your program. That is, if you have a single precision, you know, if you declare a variable single precision, okay, and then you operate on that variable, you would probably expect that the variable will remain as single precision through the computation. However, this is not true in C in general. Especially when you're on the CPU, even if you have a single precision variable, if you divide it, okay, with a double precision variable, or if you pass the variable to a function, it gets automatically converted into a double precision. In the first generation of GPU, this doesn't happen because there's no double precision in the hardware. So the compiler does not do any double precision conversion for you. So if you declare something as a double precision and you pass it to other functions as a parameter, if you divide it and so on, it will remain as a single precision. If you declare a single precision, it will remain as single precision. However, as soon as you start to use a GPU with double precision capabilities, these new GPUs will have the more
C semantics. The compilers will start to convert some of these single precision into double precision. And the very subtle thing that most people miss is actually the constants. Because in the first generation CPU, you provide a floating point constant, it will always become a single precision floating point number in the machine. However, whenever there is a double precision capability in the GPU, according to C, the default for floating point constant is actually double precision. So you can suddenly get a lot more double precision calculations than you expected, okay? And you will see the speed decrease. The double precision calculations are about 1/10 the speed of the single precision. So if you don't require double precision because it's a C semantics, you will automatically get double precision and you start to see a fairly obvious performance reduction, okay, in your code. So you can ensure that you use a single precision by using a lowercase f at the end of your constant. And you can, you know, use floating point version of the standard library functions, like instead of using sign, you can use sign f to make sure that the parameter does not get automatically converted into double precision numbers. And a lot of the CUDA programmers miss this one. Okay, and they can actually run into fairly big performance losses and then spend a lot of time to figure out what happened. Yes?
Does CUDA have a preprocessor flag that will do this for you automatically, or?
No, I don't know about the preprocessor flag. Do you know any preprocessor?
I know off the top of my head.
Right. It wouldn't make sense. If someone says, you know what, floating point proof all my, you know, you want to write one?
Okay.
Yeah, you know what, I think, but let's check with these, you know, check first and see if someone else already wrote one. I'm not aware of one. Okay, so there are a few things that this chip deviates from the IEEE floating point. You know what, GAD, you know, addition and multiplication are compliant, so that's good. You know what that means? It's never going to give you more than half of your unit of the last in the last place. And the reason is all the inaccuracies actually come from the precision. So when you generate a result, you need to eventually fit it into your representation. So by running to the nearest, you'll never lose or add more than half of your least place. So that's why they will proudly say that for multiplication and addition, it's always going to be no more than half of the ULP, okay, units in the least place, okay. When you go interview, this is one of the popular questions of some of these, you know, GPU companies and so on. And you know what, if you know what ULP means, that already boosted you quite a bit, you know, in terms of their evaluation. However, you often, you know what, these hardware often combine into multiply and add functions. This is where the accuracy can differ. The IEEE standard actually says if you have a floating point multiply add instruction, the intermediate result should actually be 80 bits in terms of precision. But in the GPU implementation, they did not add that intermediate, you know what, precision. So when you do the multiplication, you will actually just generate the single precision, you know what, precision, and then move on to do the add. So you may end up losing a little bit accuracy, you know, if you move your code on the CPU, because the CPU does that intermediate representation. Now, division is non-compliant. You know what, it actually gives you, you know what, two ULP, and not all the rounding modes are supported. And if you go into rather than division, you use a multiplication reciprocal, you will actually get even less accuracy. You'll get less than two ULP. Okay. The normalized numbers are not supported in the G80, but now it's supported in 280, and then no mechanism to detect floating point exceptions.
So essentially, you know, this is one of the biggest complaints that people have about GPU computing. They say if you generated a bad value, there's no way for the hardware to raise an exception, and then, you know, I can handle the exception. And the reason is, this is a piece of hardware that generates graphics, okay? And when someone is in the heat of a game, okay, and then, you know, you're shooting all the monsters and then all the saliva coming your way, you know what? The last thing you want to have is exception, right? You know, if something is bad, you know, it may as well just be one of those bad pixels, right, that gets displayed on the screen. It's not going to look any more ugly than the saliva from the monster, okay? So nobody cares, okay? But in the numerical computation, sometimes when you have a, you know, bad value, that means something like, you know, a nuclear bomb is supposed to blow up, it didn't. Okay, so then it's bad. Okay, so there are some differences in the usage. So eventually there will be some kind of mechanism to support this. So now, before I let you go, if you look at the tables, now you understand precision. You understand, you know, rounding modes. You understand the normalized numbers. You understand not a number, you know, all ones in your exponent. You understand over, we didn't talk about overflow in infinity, but infinity is also one of those, you know, all one bit patterns. Flags, we didn't talk much about it. Square root, you know what, it's software only, because if you want to do square root, you have to do what? Reciprocal of square root, reciprocal square root. So you need to use hand to change that, right? Division is also software only, and then reciprocal estimate, you know what? So you do have, you know, some of these estimate accuracy to be, you know, quite good, you know, 23 bits, 24 bits. They're in general about 2 ULP. But when you combine these things, you can actually have a little bit more than 2 ULP. That's where you start to deviate even more. John?
So it's not truly manual. If you use the compiler use fast math option that he showed you, it will automatically generate that sequence for you.
Ah, okay. So again, you need to set a flag because you need to volunteer. So you need to tell the compiler, yes, I'm willing to take any consequence of any kind of loss of accuracy. So if you use the flag, you don't need to do the manual change. Yes?
Is there an underscore underscore square root?
Is there an underscore underscore square root?
No,
I don't believe so.
Just that one without setting use fast math?
I would assume that there is, actually, in that it automatically generates.
Yeah, it would make sense. Yeah. But I don't
know if it's in there or not.
Right.
It
me either.
Implement.
Yeah. So do a quick check and let me know. Okay. Okay. Any other questions? Yes.
So in the kernel, what does just a square root on its own without that double underscores mean?
That means that it's actually calling a function, and that function in this generation will be inlined into the kernel. So you will eventually see a sequence of instructions that does the iterative implementation. Okay? So I will see you next time.